How many of you were impacted in some way by the ministry of Dr. Billy Graham? Maybe through a book, or you went to a crusade or something like that? Yeah, it's just so many people. I never saw him in person, but one of my memories of him, and I shared this with you once before, but one of my memories of Dr. Graham was when my dad and his companion were visiting us a number of years ago, actually right after my daughter Amelia was born. We were living in New Brunswick, and my dad was just, the surface was just kind of being scratched for him to come to know the Lord. And we're sitting in the living room and the TV's on, and there was a Dr. Billy Graham. It was a crusade that I don't know where he was at that time. And we're just kind of talking there in the living room, and my dad goes, shh, shh, I'm trying to listen to this. And it was a wonderful moment for me. I'll just never forget that. And so we are thankful to the Lord for Dr. Billy Graham. We were watching a video that somebody had been circulating on the internet of what it said on the video. It was entitled that it was his last sermon, and he was 95 at the time, and sharing the same gospel that he had shared all through his life. But I got thinking, I just wanted to make an observation of what he said in that particular message. Speaking of America, the United States, he said, "Our country is in great need of a spiritual awakening. There have been times," he said, "that I've wept as I've gone from city to city, when I've seen how far people have wandered from God." And the reason that caught my attention is because of what we talked about last Sunday. Remember when Jesus was coming into Jerusalem, the triumphal entry, and the people are cheering, just anticipating that their relief from Roman oppression was finally about to be broken. And yet as Jesus is riding that donkey down from the Mount of Olives, he's looking across at the city, and he's just bitterly weeping, just sobbing with tears, because he knew that the people had missed Jesus, and he knew what the future held for them. There was a day of impending judgment, and Dr. Billy Graham had that heart. He says as he went from city to city, sometimes he just wept for lost people, because he had that spiritual discernment, that sensitivity. Man, these people need God. These people need Jesus. And then he would go and bring the gospel to whoever would listen. So that just fit in so well with what we were talking about last Sunday. But that's just one expression of the love of God in our lives, that we weep over those who are losing or are going to be lost forever because they don't know Jesus and they haven't come to experience his forgiveness. To love people like Christ is our calling. Actually, Dr. Billy Graham said, it's God's job to judge, and it's my job to love. And that's absolutely true. And that's our calling. We're to love like Christ loved. And there's a great example for us in the text that Spike read for us. I'm sure it's familiar to many of us in John's Gospel, chapter 13. We're in the final week of Jesus' earthly ministry years. In fact, from here right through to Easter on April the 1st. And that's not April Fool's. Easter is on April the 1st. So do be here. But from now, we're going to spend time looking at a few things, all that transpired in the last week, and in fact, actually the last couple of days. So our messages are all going to build toward the cross and then the resurrection of Christ. And so in our passage in John chapter 13, Jesus and his disciples are preparing to celebrate the Passover meal. It's only hours before Jesus will be arrested and his passion will begin to unfold. And so here in this upper room, they're about to share this memorial Jewish meal, and Jesus has some final words of instruction and encouragement, and part of that instruction comes through this most vivid object lesson to demonstrate what love looks like in practice and in attitude. So John chapter 13, I'm going to read just the first five verses again. I'm not going to read all 17 that we read earlier, but I will refer to a couple of those verses, but I just want to read verses 1 to 5 again for you. So it's just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. Not just in this particular passage, obviously, but what he was about to do at the cross. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. And after that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet drying them with the towel that was wrapped around them. So this is utterly unexpected from the disciples. Jesus gets up from the meal. They're having some conversation, and Jesus gets up as the meal is about to be served or is in the process of being served. And Jesus takes off his outer garments, grabs a towel and a pitcher of water and a basin, and starts to wash their feet. Now, foot washing wasn't uncommon. There were, you know, if you were wealthy enough to have servants in your household, then servants would do that. But the actually, a Jewish servant would not be expected to wash anybody's feet. Only a non-Jewish servant. This was for the lowliest of servants to do. And yet here's the King of Love laying aside his majesty, grabbing a towel and a basin of water, and washing the feet of these sinful men that he had called into companionship with him. It's really an incredibly powerful moment if you understand the culture of the day and when you understand who Jesus is. The God of glory, the Son of God. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and here he is washing men's feet. Peter's reaction is understandable. Lord, are you going to wash my feet? It's almost like, what are you doing? You're my Lord. What are you, you know, because it's not long before this. It was Peter who said, when Jesus said, who do you say that I am? And Peter said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. You're the Messiah. You're the Son of God. What are you doing washing my feet? You have no business doing this. See, it was very unexpected for them. And the question is, why would Jesus do such a thing? Now, we're going to obviously identify this as a loving task, but why would he do that? Why would he suddenly get down, seemingly out of the blue, and just start washing their feet? Well, there's a little more information for us over in the Gospel of Luke. The other Gospel writers don't include as much information about what happened at the Passover feast. They mostly just cover the meal itself and the inauguration of that meal, which, by the way, we're going to participate in next Sunday. We've bumped it ahead a couple of Sundays. We're going to have Communion Sunday next Sunday because we're going to focus in on that text and that event for our message. But in Luke chapter 22, back in verses 24 to 27, so they're there participating in the Lord's Supper. And it says this in verse 24. Also a dispute, Luke says, arose among them as to which of them was considered to be the greatest. And Jesus said to them, the king of the Gentiles lorded over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. So what you have to understand in the context of what's going on here, you got the disciples who actually are repeating something that has happened previously. They're having this debate, and the word is contentious discussion about who's the greatest. They've spent 3 years with Jesus, and they're arguing about who's the greatest among them. Now, this happened not long before this. If we go back to Mark's Gospel, in chapter 9, Jesus is with his disciples up in Galilee in the village of Capernaum, and they're in someone's house, and Jesus comes into that house. The disciples are already there, and that's what they're doing. He says to them, what are you arguing about? And they had been arguing about who was the greatest, to which Jesus responds, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and servant of all. That's in Mark 9:33 and following. Then in Mark chapter 10, you read about the request of James and John. Do you remember what they asked Jesus if he would do this for them when he came into his glory? Let me sit at your right and my brother at my left, at your left. All right? In fact, the mother was involved in this request at all. So they wanted to sit at the right and the left of Jesus when he came into his glory. And the Bible says the other disciples were indignant about this. And so Jesus again has to say to them, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. And then he adds those wonderful words, for the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So he's repeating it. So you got to get this picture in your mind as they're having the Passover feast. This is the third time Jesus has had to deal with this attitude, this arrogance of these guys saying, I'm better than you. And they were kind of ranking themselves. The word for great, you know, who is the greatest among you? The word for great in the Greek is the simple word mega, right? You understand that something is mega big, right? So these are the guys, who's the mega man in the midst, right? And they're arguing about this for the third time, at least the third time that we know of. So this time, Jesus, he does say a little bit in Luke's account there, but this time he's going to give them a vivid illustration. And so he takes off his garments on the outside and gets down on his knees in the hands of God in the flesh, start washing these men's feet. And then he asks them, he says, do you understand what I have done for you? And I don't think they did. And then Jesus added in verses 13 to 15 of John chapter 13, you call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Now, is Jesus commanding that you all wash each other's feet? I would wash your feet. I wouldn't be bothered by that. We don't have any express command for the church to do this. The apostles never advocated this in their teaching. We don't see it elsewhere in the New Testament. We do see in great measure the aspect of serving one another, though, don't we? But we are called to be people who will serve, and by our lowly service, it gives evidence that we are disciples of Jesus. I entitled this message, you probably noticed it earlier, A High Calling to Lowly Serving. Being a servant of Christ is a high calling because we have to love exceptionally, even to the point of doing the most lowly of tasks for people, simply out of love and as a motivation or motivated by the fact that we were loved, that God himself was willing to get on his knees and get his hands dirty to wash the feet of others. Jesus gave us a wonderful object lesson that says to us what Christian love looks like when it's willing to go to the lowliest ways of serving for the blessing of one another. And there are so many ways we can express that. I know many of you are be familiar with Mother Teresa and the work that she did among the poor, especially among children in Calcutta, India. She once said, we cannot do great things on earth, only small things with great love. We cannot do great things on earth, only small things with great love. We actually have a friend, a young lady who was just a young person when we were first ministering in Ontario, but we've known their family for years. And after she graduated from a university out in British Columbia, she decided she wanted to go on a mission trip, so she went to Calcutta. Not a Catholic background, but she just wanted to go do mission work, and so she went to work with those who worked with Mother Teresa in Calcutta. And she shared with us a bit of that experience. She said that there were so many children came to the place where she was staying and helping out. So many children came showing up for food, some clearly in need. Others probably didn't need the food, but hey, the food was free, so they came along as well. And so thinking the way she did, she asked one of the nuns, well, who do I give the food to? She said, all of them, until they stopped coming. And so they just fed them and fed them and fed them, whether they needed it or not, because they were doing what they were doing in love. And it was great sacrificial service. Now, I'm not saying you need to go overseas to practice the lowly service that Christ is modeling for us here. We can do it right here at home as well. I want to share this illustration with you from Philip Yancey's book, Prayer, Does It Make Any Difference? He shares the story of a man who loved and cared for his wife as she battled Alzheimer's disease. It says this, and I'll just read it right out of the book. Yancey says, I will never forget sitting in the bedroom of a tiny house in Columbia, South Carolina, watching Robertson McQuilkin feed homemade soup to his wife spoonful by spoonful, laughing, talking to her, stroking her cheek, wiping off the spilled food. She could raise one arm and wave it, though she made no sounds and showed no sign of recognizing her husband of 40 years. McQuilkin had resigned as president of a Christian college to care for his wife Muriel, a former teacher and media personality in her own right before the onset of Alzheimer's. For 20 years, he took on the responsibility, canceling most speaking engagements and interrupting his own projects to remain available to her. "Why?" Yancey asked. "I took a vow before God," he told me, "in sickness and in health." Isn't that what love is all about? Indeed, a godly man who understood the object lesson of Jesus. You see, the ways we practice the lesson of Jesus washing the disciples' feet are many. We can make a whole list of things here. It can be helping in a food bank or a shelter for the homeless. It can be cleaning toilets in a church camp. It can be mowing the lawn or shoveling snow for an elderly or shut-in. It could be part of a hospice team, driving someone to an appointment who can't drive. So many ways that we can show love to other people. And I know, I haven't been here but 3 months, and I know that you are a loving group. I know you model the kind of love we're talking about today, and God bless you for that. Those are good things that demonstrate that Jesus is your Lord and Savior of your life. But there's so many expressions, and it just flows from a heart that knows that we belong to Christ, and if Christ can get on his knees and wash men's feet and then spread his arms on the cross and die for me, oh, let me have that kind of love for other people. In Philippians chapter 2, the Apostle Paul gives us the attitude behind that as well. And I'm sure that you know these verses very, very well. Paul says this in Philippians chapter 2, verse 1, "If you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, any fellowship with the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. Do nothing out of selfish ambition." That's our world, isn't it? We live in the world of me-ism and selfies, and it's all about us. He says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking on the very nature of a servant. Being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross." Jesus sets the example not only with what he did with his hands, but with the attitude of his heart. When the Spirit of God comes into your life, when Jesus gets a hold of you, when you've been redeemed, there's a transformation that takes place within us, right? And we start loving in ways that we didn't love before. Life was all about us, but then we started learning about Jesus and learning to love others and finding the joy that comes through that. And that's the kind of thing, but it's an attitude of the heart that just comes from the Spirit of God at work in us and learning what the Scriptures say, and we start to think, man, life's not about me. God will take care of my needs, but if there's a way I can love somebody else, then Lord, show me how to do that. And as I said, I know that many of you are doing that, so God bless you for that. But Paul's just appealing to the church at Philippi and to us to make sure that we guard against this me-focused thinking, the selfishness. It's always been around. It's been plaguing man since the fall in the garden. But learn to be people who are sensitive to the needs and interests of others, and then reaching out, if possible, and if necessary, to be a blessing to them. This is the high calling that we have in Christ. Pastor and teacher John Piper said this: "God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him, and that this satisfaction in him comes to its peak when it overflows in joy in God that meets the needs of others." In other words, it produces love. When we are at rest in our relationship with God, we understand what Christ has done, the redemption we've received, that we stand to inherit the eternal blessings of heaven. When we understand that and we know that it was all because of what Jesus did at the cross, then that gets a hold of us and we start seeing love, the fruit of love being produced in our lives, and it's demonstrated in what we do for other people. The author, Francis Schaeffer, wrote a wonderful little book just called The Mark of a Christian. He said the mark of a true Christian isn't that they go to church. The mark of a true Christian isn't just that they're moral people or benevolent people. He said the mark of a Christian is love like Christ loved and for Christ. That's the mark. Remember, in fact, even a little further down in John chapter 13, Jesus said what? A new commandment I give to you, love one another. As I have loved you, by this will all men know that you are my disciples, that you have love one for another. So Jesus sets this wonderful example for us of what love looks like, as he has in all the passages we've looked at through the month of February. Let me share one final illustration and then I'll close. I don't know if we have an image up here. Do we have an image of Dave Thomas? Okay, we just have his name up there? Okay, some of you know who Dave Thomas is, right? Oh, is it right there? Oh, you see, I have a different screen. Cool. All right. So you guys know that happy face, don't you? Right? Yeah. Kind of looks like you a little bit, Reg. I'm just thinking, yeah, you look like a little bit like that. Yeah, just at a glance. But you know, he passed away about 10 years ago. But for a number of years, Dave did his, he was the face of the Wendy's commercials, right? Wonderful man, very godly man, actually. But for a number of years, if you look in the Wendy's corporate manual, there's a picture of Dave holding a mop in his hand with a bucket of water nearby. It was included to show that the founder of that international company was not above his staff and was willing to do whatever needed to be done, including mopping floors. The owner of a corporate business was not concerned about getting his hands dirty and mopping floors. Someone made the observation that there should be the letters MBA after his name. Mop and bucket attitude. I think that's a great memory for him to leave for us. But that's what Jesus is looking for, folks, a mop and bucket attitude. Is there anything too lowly that you would not do out of love for somebody? I hope not. I hope not. Because when you're willing to go low and answer the high call, then you are being the hands and feet of Jesus to somebody.